Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. Welcome to the Hoban Minute. I am sitting alongside the captain of the USS Hoban Law Group, Mr. Bob Hoban. Bob, it's been a long time. How are you doing?
It's been a long time. It's been good. Things are good. How are you?
I'm doing good. And even though it's been a long time that we've been back here and crystallizing our experiences for the last couple of months here on this podcast, we've been doing a lot of things. And that is in no small part due to the fact that there is an energy about, there is a reopening, there is a return to normalcy in some sense. I know you've been traveling a little bit. You've gotten back down to South America and Mexico, especially, where exciting things are happening, which we'll talk a little bit about right now. We also were at the NOCO Hemp Expo. And Bob, how does it feel kind of a year later from when we started this thing to be getting back into more of a normal groove?
Well, I mean, it's seeing other people get back into the groove is kind of the thing, right? It's understanding that there's still a significant portion of our population that will be gun shy, so to speak, to start going back into gatherings, et cetera. I think for many of us in Colorado, because we live life outdoors so much, and because it's things have not been as locked down for the better part of the last year, that I'm not here to say that life has been normal, but it's been pretty close to normal for, I think, a large portion of us. And seeing people get back together again and to appreciate their hesitancy and to recognize that and to be sensitive to those types of things, it's actually kind of cool, because I feel like, having gotten coronavirus myself back in the fall, that once you've gotten through that, it kind of opened up a whole nother world. And I think people that are getting the vaccines, they start to feel that way. It's not bulletproof, but at the same time, it is encouragement, and it opens the door to step back and to start doing normal things again. It is sad that, because of all this, that's been the implication and the repercussion of the public health measures. But at the same time, we're starting to see things come back together. If you were out anytime in the last 2 to 4 weeks in Denver, restaurants are open. They're almost at capacity. Things are back to normal. I was in Florida for spring break with my family. In Florida, things have seemingly been normal for months and months and months and months now, to the point where most people aren't even wearing masks. So I don't judge that. I just observe that. So I guess my point is, sort of seeing things come back around, it feels good. Not for me, because my life's been pretty much the same. It feels good to see other people getting more comfortable and more confident to get back into the groove. And whatever normal or the new normal is, it's just good to see people getting back together again, because that really is what drives us all.
Yeah, that's a better way to characterize it, in seeing other people. And it is interesting, because, you know, my understanding is that the vaccine kind of makes you feel crappy, but then you get better. And you know, I know for you and for myself, it was like, that's what the virus did. You felt pretty bad, but then you got better. And in that getting better was a perspective changer around, that sucked, but hey, I'm still here. And, you know, I can, at least for a little while, I can not be overly concerned about this thing.
Yes.
So, you know, we had a lot of great conversations in the anticipation and run up to the November election. We postulated a lot. And, you know, even on this thread about different parts of the country reacting very differently to COVID now and what their policies are, that is a microcosm of something else, which is that this country is made up of a lot of different parts and pieces, and it's very hard to jam all of those things into one thing and call it a country. You know, we see this all the time. We saw this in the election. We see this with the political divide. We see it with the differing of opinions on all kinds of issues, all of which are made political, as we've talked about, the over politicization of every issue imaginable. But I want to talk a little bit, because we haven't spent a lot of time sitting here since January of this year. Have you been surprised? What surprised you since the Trump administration handed over the baton to the Biden administration. Maybe you haven't been surprised. Maybe you've kind of, you know, in the same way that, you know, you've maintained a sense of normalcy for yourself throughout the COVID experience, which I think, it, you know, is a very, very valuable thing in this political experience. And in this time when we are, you know, emotions are really sweeping there. It's a very wave-like effect that you feel with people getting so upset, so in their position on things. It's kind of nice to be a neutron. It's kind of nice to be neutral sometimes and kind of feel more like an observer, just kind of sit back. And so I'm interested, you know, in the last couple of months, has anything surprised you or are we status quo?
Well, I mean, look, we no longer have a leader who's so erratic and inflammatory that it draws the attention of the press 24 hours, 7 days a week. That's a refreshing thing. But have things changed? I don't necessarily think that. The government still beats on. The rhetoric from the new administration is far more benign. Certainly there's more focus on putting different policies in place in different levels of the government, but that takes time. Oftentimes 6 months, a year or more for those new policies to really take effect. So it's been nice, not political, as that neutron, as that neutral observer. It's been nice to not have people so inflamed every single day because of someone that's supposed to be our leader can't say the right things or do the right things. That's a nice thing. But I don't know if much has changed. I feel like everything is pretty much the same. The coronavirus rebound, et cetera, that's always been left to the states by design. It still is today. There's no changes there. The fact of the matter is that we're going down a road with a new presidential administration, and it's going to take them time to effectuate those changes, those policy changes. That takes time. You can't just, you know, turn a cruise liner to the right or to the left. You have to slowly but surely navigate it to a certain point. So the potential effects of those changes with the Biden administration will be long lasting, but will also take some time. Now, as we talk about our topic, the cannabis topic, we're shot out of a cannon here in 2021, in large part because we have a vice president that sponsored the MORE Act that previously had passed the House. And there are signs from the Democratic leadership, Chuck Schumer in particular, in the Senate to drive forward not only a banking bill, which passed out of the House the other day, significant progress, but also drive forward elements of the MORE Act, the social justice, the reform elements of cannabis, but coupled with some commercialization elements. So for our industry, we see things driving forward. It's reinvigorated, to your point. It's like a shot in the arm to our industry because now we're focused. We're moving forward. We're coming out of the pandemonium, the pandemic, of course, and we're moving forward in this industry. So only time will tell. But I don't know if it's drastically different. Do you see it as different? Because I would tell you the one thing that is different, and I follow all the news sources on a daily basis just to be well-read and understand what's going on. From CNN to Fox News to extreme left and extreme right. I read it all because I want to be able to make an evaluation for myself. I want to read the propaganda and figure out what the middle of the road story is. Most people aren't that way. Do you think things have changed?
What I noticed in the month after January 21st was just a kind of quiet. The same, I think, that you're saying, which is it's hard to make news about Joe Biden every day.
Just doing his job. He's not trying to be inflammatory.
It's not.
What's news about a guy doing his job?
Exactly. And I think the ironic thing, being that neutral observer sometimes, is that we like to think about a lot of things like this, but on the political spectrum, we like to think that it's a line, right? It's a linear thing, and there you have the far right and the far left in the middle. But what if it's really more of like a circle?
Because what if it's a coin and either one's just the other side of it?
Exactly. Those extremes on either side at a certain point are very close to each other. And that's the thing that is kind of funny to me, that we just, it's hard to sometimes know, because you can be really, really embedded. You can really dig yourself into a position to the point where it's a little difficult to see where the point is that you fall on these things. And I don't know. I try to find the humor in it. I try to be a little bit entertained by it, because the alternative for me is to be the person who's overly angry all the time, to be stressed out about it. And I just find, in this conversation that we had previously with Jesse, I'm passionate about the thing that I get to spend most of my time with. And that's a special thing. And so, this is an issue, as we've talked about, that does seem to be bipartisan. It actually brings people together more so than many of the other things out there that tend to push people apart. And that excites me, because I like to try to find the places where we can find some commonality and some common ground. This is my question for you. Being shot out of a cannon, and being that cannabis seems well positioned from a federal legislation point of view, you seem to have the support now of the decision makers in Washington. So here's my question. What are the obstacles now? We have a number of states that have enacted programs successfully. There are still issues at the state level, but what, in your mind, if you had to, maybe it's one, two, or three, what are the obstacles that are standing in the way of some federal legalization? Is it truly special interests? Is it the groups out there who benefit by cannabis being prohibited that would try to lobby maybe against it? Is it, I don't know, that somebody's fear of if they stand in support of cannabis, they feel they might not get reelected because they are elected from a jurisdiction that is maybe really religious and sees cannabis as a bad thing? Where do you see the obstacles that are standing in the way at this point?
Well, there's certainly a lot of that. And when I say that, it's what you mentioned just a couple seconds ago. And that is, yes, there are politicians that, particularly conservative politicians, listen, make no mistake about it. The legalization of cannabis is a completely conservative Republican issue. It is a individual freedoms. It is a states' rights. It is an economic policy. But politicians, especially ones that are not learned on the subject, cannot go out on a limb in a jurisdiction where the wisdom is that cannabis is the devil's lettuce. It's a terrible, deleterious drug, and it's adverse to society. So you can't change that. You can over time, but that's not going to necessarily be a significant impediment. I mean, think of it this way. Is it a priority is really what I look at. You've got the pandemic. You've got racial tension at least recent years, all time high. We've got so many things happening in this country that can you put cannabis front and center, especially when people don't see it the way we see it. They don't see it as a way to create jobs. They don't see it as a benign or even a beneficial thing to society. They don't follow the articles, the science. They don't know what's happening all around the world like we do. So to introduce cannabis legalization into the topic would just seem out of place. Somebody, even somebody that's open or supportive of the concept, could say, why are you prioritizing cannabis legalization right now when we have all these other things that are happening around the world and in society and to us from a public health and an economic standpoint? So I think that's a major impediment. We also have a little bit of a wild card in the Oval Office. And what I mean by that is our president, and we've talked about this before, objectively has enacted legislation that has changed the composition of the federal prison complex from majority white to majority black and brown in just a few decades. And a lot of those offenses that were criminalized had to do with drug policy, criminalization of cannabis, three strikes and you're out, so forth and so on. My point being, we also saw recently that the Biden administration terminated employees for prior cannabis use in the White House. I'm sure there's more to that story besides their prior cannabis use. But there's this inconsistent messaging where you've got Chuck Schumer in the Senate saying, let's do this. Come on, let's go. And you've got a lot of support among very powerful and influential Democrats, particularly on the Senate side, but also some influential Republicans. Yet you don't have that direct drive and leadership from the White House. Does education need to take place? Is the president sort of stuck in his ways, so to speak, and about how he's always viewed cannabis? Does his son's drug use color his thinking on how cannabis should be poised and treated? Is it old school thinking? Is it, as I read an article on, I think, CNN the other day, is his cannabis policy 10 years behind? These are things that we don't have answers to. I think that's the impediment of preventing the mainstream change. Now, it will be incremental. Here's my prediction, even though you didn't ask for a prediction. What you're going to see is the banking bill pass. We saw it come out of the House. Will it come out of the Senate? It's likely that it can come out of the Senate. If it doesn't come out of the Senate, it will come back again, and it will keep coming back and revised over the next year and a half until it does pass. So when the banking bill passes, that allows banks to handle cannabis dollars like any other industry. While that does not expressly carve out public market access, meaning NASDAQ and New York Stock Exchange, to marijuana companies, what it does do is it opens up banking on a national scale. So you'll start to see these dollars that are already out there become more powerful, built up, pent up even, to be spent in an industry once legalization is finally approved. Because as we've talked about, even if the Banking Act passes and all these financial reserves, institutional dollars come in, they're ready to be expended in the cannabis industry. And even if that prompts legalization to happen 18, 24 months later, which is probably, that's my prediction, that's how it will occur, it's still going to take years, and I mean years, for the federal government to enact regulations and policies to implement that law. So we're not out of the woods. We're not even close to being out of the woods, but it is going to be driven by the almighty dollar. But the impediment seems to be a bit of an unknown, a wild card in the White House. And I say that with love. I don't say that in a way where I say, this guy, what the heck's he thinking? I say that, and we don't know, because his track record as a politician is not favorable to these issues. And it is, frankly, in line with some of the mainstream Democrat Party policy that has been, well, if we're going to legalize it, we should just reschedule it and pave the way for pharmaceutical companies to research it and access it for medicine, coupled with some criminal justice relaxation or reform measures. That does not create a commercial cannabis industry in the United States. And that's what we've demonstrated as a whole can work, will work, and is sweeping the globe.
That idea of prioritization makes a lot of sense when you put it in that way. And it's even made a little more obvious coming off of this last year, when it would be easy for somebody to attack a politician for being really outspoken about wanting to.
We're dealing with all these problems and you want to legalize cannabis? What do you think? I mean, think about that. You right. know?
But here's the point where I'm not going to call it hypocrisy, but I am going to call it not looking hard enough around, right? Because one of the biggest things that is on the political agenda for the Biden administration is climate responsibility. I mean, this was promised. This was forecast. We knew that this was going to come as a result of Trump being taken out of office, getting back into the Paris Climate Accord, going and meeting with international leaders to discuss what the plan is and really to position the United States as a leader in crafting a sustainable future. So we saw the proposal, and you can go and find it on the Joe Biden website, for a $2 trillion climate spending plan. That's great. There's a lot of different components to that: infrastructure, building better buildings, building better roads, building things that don't break down so quickly, using better materials, using plant-based materials. Here's hemp. So here's the part of the cannabis plant that is federally legal. We know that Tom Vilsack has been straight up asked this question, and we saw even reporters at the Hemp Industry Daily basically positing the question, are we moving toward a scenario where we're not going to see hemp subsidized the same way that corn is subsidized? We're likely not going to see the federal government give tons of money to farmers to grow hemp just for the sake of growing it, just to get the production up, just to get more grain and more fiber. But what about a carbon subsidy? What about the idea that you grow this plant, we know that the plant sequesters some carbon from the atmosphere, and we will pay you for that amount of carbon that was sequestered through the form of credits, this carbon trading, carbon credits. It's a beautiful idea, and it was absolutely one of the things that was really talked about at the NOCO hemp event this last time around. It was almost like the 2019 NOCO hemp event was all about CBD. That was the big C that year. The big C this past year was carbon. Mm-hmm. Everybody was talking about it. Nobody is even close to getting any money from the government on carbon, but everybody wants it. And everybody's really proliferating that dream. And it's probably in no small part because of the Kiss the Ground documentary, which highlighted these issues around soil, highlighted the need for regenerative agriculture and restorative agriculture. So I'm interested, Bob. I mean, you've been doing stuff with hemp for a long time. You've been navigating the industry. You've been connecting the dots, trying to get this stuff planted here in the United States. Is this feasible? Is this likely something that's going to happen? Are we going to see federal support come in the form of some kind of carbon payment to farmers for doing this, for growing this crop?
Well, first of all, you have to be able to measure how much does the hemp plant actually remove from the atmosphere. That largely has to do with chlorophyll levels. And you can measure that through sensors with monitoring plants to determine how much is actually sequestered from. But then you have to do something with the plant. You don't just want to take it out of the atmosphere. You've got to put the plant to a use where that carbon is effectively not re-released back into the atmosphere. That closes the loop on the cycle. If you can demonstrate that in a manner that is, you know, satisfactory to a government, then in fact you have that. Yes, carbon credits for hemp will be made available once those types of things are perfected on a wider scale, because the science would seem to show that hemp does a pretty darn good job of removing carbon from the atmosphere compared to other plants, maybe even a better job than other plants. But how do you measure that, and how do you put an appropriate value on that? So if I grow 1,000 acres of hemp, it's not good enough that I removed whatever that quantity of carbon from the atmosphere is. It's, what am I going to do with that plant now? Can I turn that plant into a viable fiber source or a herd source for building materials, which not only replaces those other harmful building materials, but is put to use in a way where you're not effectively, eliminating the removal by putting it back into the atmosphere. So that is the cycle that needs to be perfected. And many, 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 many smart people and researchers are working on that right now. So that is the thing. And then when that's done, you will see carbon credits traded surrounding industrial hemp, because they're traded regarding other crops that are far less impactful from reducing and removing that from the atmosphere. It's about completing the cycle and measuring it and validating.
It also comes back to what you've talked about for so long, which is the whole plant. You can't, if you're growing for a single purpose, if you're just growing for that grain and the plan is to burn the stock that got left over in the field, well, if you're burning the stocks, where is all that? That's just going right back up there. You've just
all for not.
Still in the cycle.
Yep.
So this highlights what I know is, I watched you in Nashville 2 years ago or more at that Southern Hemp Expo, and you were speaking a language in that room that people were not ready for yet, Bob.
No,
it was like a whole plant approach, and it makes perfect sense, and it is, on the idea of a building material. To you're locking that in. and you're locking that in for a long time. I mean, that's not like a t-shirt, which, you know, a t-shirt is great to make out of hemp, but if the t-shirt only lasts a couple of years, how, you know, yeah, it got locked in, but it didn't get locked in for as long of a period of time as if you build, you just start building everything mm-hmm. with herd. So this brings us to another point, which I, you know, this, again, this has been a big conversation in the hemp space. And it's a big conversation in the cannabis space as well, which is, you said there's a lot of complex issues in this country. There's complex issues around race. There's complex issues around class. And one group that kind of falls right in the target middle of a lot of those kinds of issues are the tribes and the tribal lands. The tribes have been first movers, in a sense, in trying to get involved with hemp and been open, seemingly, to the idea of trying to get legal cannabis or recreational cannabis on the tribal lands. It's another economic driver. It's something that you can put next to that casino to try to put a little bit of economic development and build the economy a little bit more. I was in South Dakota this past summer, and we were on a reservation, and there was a casino, and at the casino, they were selling CBD. And guess what? You can't sell CBD anywhere else in South Dakota. So it was like, they were taking advantage of that opportunity. And so I'm interested in, you know, because I know Tay Darnell is a close friend and colleague of yours. You know, kind of where do you think the opportunity is for the tribes, whether it's on the hemp side or the marijuana side?
Well, so let's we have to look at the last several years to sort of paint this picture. So early on, when states began to legalize cannabis, some forward thinkers began to go to tribal leaders in different places, trying to take advantage of, to maximize the use of the perception of sovereignty, right? Native American lands, Native American organizations and tribes have rights that oftentimes exist outside of or without regard to federal law. So many people went to those places, and especially with hemp, and they determined that the 2014 Farm Bill, and this was a court case in federal court, the Menominee tribe, plants were cut down. The court determined that tribal lands, tribes were not covered within the 2014 Farm Bill, which is really what caused CBD to proliferate across the country. Because it didn't mention tribes. It mentioned universities, it mentioned states, so forth and so on. So the court read that to say, well, if you're a tribe, you have to still get permission from that state to do this. So then there was an issue. So then there was a lot of lobbying effort, and another great friend of ours, Robert Martin, a great Native American lawyer and judge in a Washington state-based tribe, he worked very hard to include industrial hemp reform as an economic opportunity in tribal legislation that was being drafted to drive economic development on tribal lands. So now that comes full circle, where we have the 2018 Farm Bill, which does expressly allow for tribal lands to exploit their sovereignty and to exploit the law so that they can cultivate industrial hemp for a variety of purposes. And we're starting to see it come around. And we're starting to see tribes understand the economic opportunity is not necessarily a get rich quick, but more akin to an agricultural opportunity, to your point, that's a little bit broader based. I worked with some tribes in about an hour to the northeast of San Diego and the southeast of Los Angeles several years ago. And there's one tribe that has a major casino. And next to that casino were some facilities where cannabis of all sorts was being cultivated. Up the hill, there was a less economically advantaged tribe that was looking at ways to do this. And they didn't know who to trust. And the law wasn't quite clear. And they also saw this wealthy tribe down the hill succeeding in different ways. So it created a lot of disparate opportunities. Well, here we are today, where tribes can actually take advantage of laws on paper at the federal level to move forward in a variety of ways with the hemp plant, and to look at ways that their sovereignty can be utilized for cannabis and cannabis-related services and development as well. So you're starting to see those things come around. And to your point, Tay is very well connected to those folks and to those tribes. But what are the opportunities? Is this another American spirit where a large company from the outside comes in and says, grow tobacco. We're going to make it organic. We're going to brand it as an American spirit, and we're going to create economic opportunities. Or is it something that is bound to fail because we've seen it already leave a scar on so many tribes across the country because they were just a little bit before the clarity came or a little bit before their time. That's what I am interested in seeing. You want to see tribes understand that the industrial hemp plant can be utilized for a variety of purposes, but it is not get rich quick, and it is not CBD only. And that's a hard sell when you have these lands, which are generally economically deprived, right? They've got casinos in certain places, as we've described, but that's not every tribal land, and that's not every tribe. And those tribes don't necessarily need so many other revenue streams. So we have to see how it plays out, but it all has to start with the notion that this has to be a sustainable whole plant use, or it's not going to succeed. That's not conjecture. That is facts. And that has been proven over and over and over again. And unfortunately, when tribal governments and tribal councils are in an economic pinch, they don't necessarily see it that way. They see it as something that will generate revenue for the short term and large amounts of revenue. And you and I both knew that's probably not true anymore.
The get rich quick scheme piece of this is dissolving a little bit. And it really is. It's a long-term industry. Quick question for you. When a tribe wants to legalize marijuana, how does that process differ than when, for example, the state of Colorado legalized marijuana?
Well, so this is where, I mean, I understand a lot of this, but I also don't understand a lot of the details. Just because tribes retain a semblance of sovereignty, meaning their ability to plot their own course and govern themselves, that is not absolute. In fact, the federal government has spent decades and decades and decades of providing services to tribes in exchange for, little by little, these tribes giving up elements of their sovereignty. And that's was because of economic need and what their population required, whether those are healthcare services, social services, support, and the like. So job creation opportunities and job centers and the like. So looking at that, it really comes down to the specific tribe. Now, one thing is clear, if you're going to go out and legalize marijuana and have some sort of marijuana operation on tribal lands, if you don't have this absolute sovereignty that's above U.S. law, then there are going to be restrictions. And those restrictions oftentimes have implications at the state and federal level. Meaning at the state level, you still need to seek land use approval and or other approvals from different state-based agencies to do what you're doing on the land. And at the federal level, if you go down the road of trying to legalize marijuana or create a marijuana commercial enterprise on a tribal land, then it provides an opportunity for the federal government to say, wait a second, this isn't legal under the federal law, under U.S. federal law, and therefore we're going to pull back the subsidies and the dollars that we provide for these other services. So it's a bit of a sticky situation for these tribes because they have to take a risk if they're going to go forward, and they're just not going to get great clarity from the state or the federal government in those types of situations.
It makes sense. So kind of bringing us into an international scope for a moment here, because I know we've seen a lot happen with Mexico. There was a lot of excitement about the potential of cannabis reform. And then the last time that we were here, we talked about the medical cannabis laws, the rules and regulations that were very, very late to be published. But now it seems that we actually are seeing adult use recreational cannabis being legalized in Mexico. And I know you've been down there, you've been working with a number of stakeholders. Just kind of walk us through what that policy is starting to shape up and look like. We know that Mexico has an election this summer, so it was very advantageous that some of these developments happened here in the spring before everybody just goes into re-election mode. What can we kind of expect from our neighbor down south?
Well, first and foremost, remember, medical marijuana legislation exists, and medical marijuana regulations were issued in January of this year. So that law is out there. There are some moving pieces as to how that's going to be implemented at certain levels. But for those interested in participating in Mexico in the medical applications of the plant, which, by the way, does include CBD. CBD, especially after the new legislation passes, and we'll talk about that in a moment, will be relegated to that medical, that scientific lane that already exists. The new legislation really talks about adult use, recreational use, dispensaries, personal rights to cultivate, and it talks about industrial hemp. Those two things have not passed yet, still haven't come back out of the Senate. And as you point out, there is an election in the summer. So that's effectively put everything on pause. For better or for worse, they're not going to reconvene and debate the merits of the pending legislation, which is required to move forward, by the way, by the Mexican Supreme Court. So they've asked for an extension, and they'll receive an extension to pass that legislation, but it won't be till reconsidered until October or November of 2021. So we have a long road ahead of us. Then it would go to the president's office for signature, and the president can take his time in considering and reviewing that. And then it will take a long time for regulations to be implemented afterwards. It took 3 years for the medical marijuana regulations to be issued from the time the legislation was enacted. So my point is, it is a long road, still very promising, still very exciting, still enormous amount of opportunities if you set things up properly now. The problem in large part is most of the Mexican citizens that I'm friends with and that we work with and talk to, they don't have faith in their government, that the government's going to actually follow through and do this. Or if it does, it's going to be changed and there'll be new elected members following these elections this summer. Those are all real concerns. So the momentum is real. It will get to the finish line. It'll just be a longer timeline than we all hoped and expected. And the future is very bright for cannabis in Mexico, but that doesn't mean things have to wait. Even industrial hemp, there are opportunities and R&D measures now that can be utilized from a legal and regulatory standpoint to begin trials, to begin registering genetics, to begin looking at economic development surrounding industrial hemp for true industrial uses, particularly across northern Mexico, where you have so many of these manufacturers and factories that use materials and goods that the hemp plant could provide environmentally friendly, lower cost replacement materials for the implementation of. So my point is, things are coming, things are changing. It's a longer timeline than we'd like, but still very positive, and it will happen.
And on the medical side, have you seen, or does there seem to be quite a bit of interest, whether that's from groups in Mexico who want to set up cultivation, extraction, distribution for those medical products? Is there interest from groups maybe in the United States who are looking at that opportunity? It, has that really started the publishing of those regulations? Has that really started to build some plans, I guess, at this stage for growth into Mexico? Maybe it's not cultivation of the actual plant and the whole supply chain existing in Mexico. Maybe it's importing certain products from places. But have you kind of seen?
Yeah, imports have occurred for what we would call API, active pharmaceutical ingredient, API grade cannabinoid materials. We saw a press release come out 8 weeks ago now, maybe, where a Colombian API grade THC oil was imported for R&D purposes into Mexico. We have several groups that we're working with right now to source additional API grade CBD and or THC for, we're talking in the grams, not even in the liters, just to sort of test the logistics and to provide research and development material, and to provide that material to the government to show that it does exist and that laying out the plans for what they're going to do with that material. So those things are happening within Mexico as we speak. We're also looking at scenarios where pharmaceutical companies and interests from the outside of Mexico are waiting for things to change, and they're working with their partners on the ground within Mexico. Mexico has a rich history of pharmaceutical ingredient production to begin with. So they're not, there's not a small number of opportunities for folks from outside of Mexico that want to work with people within Mexico to take advantage of the existing law. And that's what we're seeing right now.
Well, this has certainly been a great come back to the studio and talk about all of these updates and kind of figure out where we can chart and start to position and be excited about certain things. And it is, I know the message since we came back into this new year and really have felt and heard from you is to try to be excited, try to get yourself into a pre-COVID mindset. It's the only way we're going to kind of rebuild. And just like you said at the very beginning, it's you feel good when you see other people starting to feel more positive, starting 100%. To change that mindset and get more positive. And, you know, the last thing I want to say is as captain of the USS HLG, this is certainly no ship of fools. So, you know, Bob, it may not always be the most fun to be the captain, but somebody's got to do it, man.
Somebody's got to be the captain. No, it is good. And just one last thing to your point, you know, that's the one thing we talk about a lot. We talk about it in the office. You can't wait for things to change around you. You just have to go change them yourself, because the opportunity does exist to be happy, to participate with people. Sitting back and saying, well, I can't wait for this to... I mean, in Colorado, sporting events are open. Concerts are coming back this summer. Once the snow stops falling, the spring, the real spring will be here, and then the summer will follow. There's a tremendous opportunity to get out and to get this post-COVID. And by the way, COVID's not going anywhere. There's no such thing as post-COVID. There's post-pandemic. Right? Let's face it. And that's the thing, is get used to a life which resembles whatever you want it to resemble. And that might be what it was like before this all started. It might be based on something different, but go out and get it, because nobody's going to give it to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.